Gary MacDonald. I teach in the department. I'm here today to talk about William Carlos Williams. The lecture title has American Modernist Poetry. I'm not going to cover that in 40 minutes. I'm not even going to cover that in half an hour. Okay? So that'll kind of come on the end or around, or it will circulate through the information on William Carlos Williams that you'll learn today. Okay? But if we think about the period that you've been looking at already on the course, and think that it's somehow not mentioned America in some way, then we're going to be able to begin today. Because around about 1910 to 1920 is generally seen as the first phase of the American modernist experiment. Okay, now that obviously encapsulates a very important set of dates between 1914 and 1918, which I'm sure no doubt some of the poetry that you've been reading so far has been discussed in relation to, okay, that Great War. And of course, the Great War itself, this bitter, awful war that Europe, not America, effectively has experienced, has made the search for meaning in and about modern culture an imperative question. And it's one with a subsequently difficult answer, as I'm sure many of you will be trying to figure out in your seminar groups, okay? It's a question that's imbued with cynicism, with things like skepticism, despair, and you know the narrative by now, okay? You've done the wasteland already, I think. Have you? You have, yeah. Not very many smiles on your face, given the fact that you've just finished the wasteland. So we have that as one of these aspects of the corollary of the search for meaning, okay, in this period. But another one might be an aspirational way to think about it, an experimental way to think differently about the way that we think about modern or modernist meaning and experience, and the way that that's somehow registered in connection with the experience of modernity, okay? So that relation is, I'm sure, again, no doubt you've been talking about between modernism and modernity will be at the core of what we've got to think about in relation to Williams. I was going to say different, but I'm not quite sure if that's the right word. Williams' distinct take on modernism. And I'm sure, as those of you that have read the handout that's been handed out to you in your seminar groups last week are aware, he has some beef with the man that you've looked at last week, okay? And we're going to get into that in the first 15 minutes or so of the lecture. The difference, if he's like, or the distinction, or the parallel arguments between Williams and Eliot become significant, I think, for reading Williams appropriately. Excuse me. So, oh, sorry. One of the main ideas that you've probably seen on LMW so far has been the way that modern literature reacts to cataclysmic changes affected by war, revolution, technology, the redrawing of national, geographical, political, economic boundaries, the growth of new forms of commercial and capitalist life, and so on and so forth. And I guess a question that underpins all that is how our literature and art to correspond or register to this change, if you like, this new, different, modern world, right? How is poetry specifically to try and incorporate or confront this newness, this unprecedented experience? You might say the shock of the modern, or the shock of the new, as it's often put on in modernist contexts. I guess so far we've been talking about the way that this urgent insistence on newness, on experiment, if you like, somehow has to work out its relationship with this thing we know as the traditional, or the orthodox, or the conventional. And yes, I guess in many ways that's a significant aspect of poets like Eliot and Yeats and so on. But I guess it wouldn't be pushing it too far today for me to argue kind of against that in many ways. If we read Williams specifically, or other forms of modernism generally, appropriately, then we start to have a problem with something called tradition. Okay, we start to worry about the way that tradition itself becomes almost a stifling, constrictive, problematic concept that, and I guess the whole history of poetry has always had a problem with. All right? And I'm going to work on that a wee bit for the next 5 minutes or so. Eliot dominated modern and, I guess, American poetry till about the 1950s. And it's actually a curious fact that it's only really the last 50 years or so that I've saw someone like William Carlos Williams come to the fore as an example of an alternative in style and method and approach. And one of the things that are often marked about Williams is the fact that he remains, unlike many other American poetic behemoths, he remains, for poetic, political, and personal reasons, in the US, rather than expatriate himself, as many other heavyweight American poets do, to London or Paris. I'm thinking primarily about Robert Frost, Ezra Pound, who many of you will know already, and of course Eliot himself, okay, who are already in England by 1910. Williams declines to do that, and it becomes an important feature for many people. It's many critics of Williams that he decides against the movement to Europe, okay? And it comes with a parallel insistence on the importance and the legitimacy of local life, not specifically American life, but of course he is from Rutherford, New Jersey, which becomes an important facet of his work. And it's significant that he stays where he is. Okay? Modernism, says Williams, can come from Nine Ridge Road, Rutherford, New Jersey. It doesn't necessarily have to appear in Berlin, Paris, New York, or any kind of metropolitan center, frankly. So the question or the theme of locality and what that does for form, as much as for the content of what Williams' works are, could be said to be about, is significant. And of course, it is, we could say, we could stretch it, that it's a specifically American locality that he's pushing, okay? And this is something that's different. And if we think about, for example, that parallel between the experience of, say, war, for example, between the States and Europe, then we have something to grapple with, okay? The US, of course, as we know it, was instrumental in forging the new moments of the 20th century history. And the new century is, you could argue, implicitly American, right? In social, cultural, even in psychological forms. All accompanying technological developments that are everywhere apparent in the US, in art, architecture, industry, science, and writing. And there's a great burst of popular and commercial culture that somehow needs addressed in correlation to that. It's also, remember, a land with millions of new people, okay? Immigrants. Frosting with new forms of language, new forms, new customs brought from old ones, and I guess new forms of expression. And there's a shift in many ways of linguistic structure into a form of American English that becomes significant for Williams himself. Okay? A particularly American vernacular is important for him in his fashioning of both form and content. And I guess if we get to the end of this decade that I began talking about at the beginning, by the end of the 1920s, it's no longer really possible to regard American literature as some people did, as a provincial literature, right? As some kind of suburb of British writing. It's no longer possible to have that kind of sniffy attitude which many writers and critics from a European perspective might have had. America had emerged from this war not as a debtor, but as a creditor nation. And I guess, in many ways, its culture begins to reflect that. The 1920s sees a whole creative flowering in this nation. And there's an explosion not only in poetry, but also in prose and in drama. Now, if we go back 15 or so years to about 1905, the depressed state of contemporary poetry in the US was readily apparent. to many. At the University of Pennsylvania, for example, in 1905, Ezra Pound and his friends, Hilda Doolittle, I guess more commonly known as HD by her initials, and William Carlos Williams, were discussing in public forums the possibility of a revitalized American poetry. And they concluded that they needed a completely different model in some sort of respect, not only for American poetry, but for poetry generally. Williams himself argues that we have to fit the modern movements in art that were growing up all around them and in Europe to somehow an American, a specifically American place and the contemporary American moment. And thus he argues for a return in some sort of respect to American speech, to a local form of fidelity. Look around you and find culture, is more or less it said in a vulgar fashion. Find the forms that exist in the street, on the road to work, at the baseball game, at the hayride, at the swap meet, in the skyscraper streets for poetry, okay? But this vernacular form, if we want to call it that, it's an arguable point, this argument, of course, tries to impart to American poetry a new substance or even a violent new kind of orientation. There's a kind of, and involved in that as an opposition to every form of poetry that depended on meter or rhyme, or orthodox meter or rhyme, what we might understand as conventional prosody, okay? Conventional versification and so on. For Williams, conventional or traditional forms would only serve to falsify the experiences that he himself was trying to transcribe. And if we want to call these experiences, as we'll look at in the poems later on, the experience of ordinariness, which is a clunky way to put it, then this will begin to take shape in his attitude towards the concept of the thing, or thinginess, as we might call it. It's weird. Everybody looks up at me and goes, what? Thinginess? He said that? Things and thinginess, okay, which becomes an important facet, as we shall see in the second half of the lecture, of Williams' work. He calls this a new measure, okay? He wants to let, as he says, the beat of speech determine the measure. He wants to rinse the language of ornament and incrustation, to rinse the language of ornament and incrustation, to be scrupulously selective in the choice of language that he uses, but also to allow somehow for accident and impingement as an important feature or registration of that language. Okay? And I think this will come out in a poem that we'll look at later on called Rapid Transit. Okay? So if you look at quote number one, he claimed of his alternative vision or method where he's going to get he calls it a variable foot, okay, where everything is allowed to get suddenly much freer, if you like, in Williams' mind. He says, what by this approach I'm trying to sketch, what we are trying to do is not only to disengage the elements of a measure, okay, to take away all the kind of laws governing, in many ways, appropriate poetry, but to seek what we believe is there, a new measure or a new way of measuring that will be commensurate with the social economic world in which we are living, as contrasted with the past in which we are living, okay? It is in many ways a different world from the past, calling for a different measure. It's as though, for the moment, we should be profuse, we Americans. We need to build up a mass, a conglomerate maybe, containing few gems but bits of them. Stop a minute to emphasize our own position. It's not that of Mr. Eliot. We are making a modern bolus. Now, just as an incidental point, Williams remained a doctor, a medical doctor all the way through his career. And some critics, of course, have made hay with this. Okay, they think that, for example, the smaller poems that we'll look at later on are examples of his busyness between shifts in the hospital, okay, that he's only got the time to write down very quick remarks and then stick them up and call them poetry. The more important thing for me here is the fact that he uses this word bolus, okay, which is a medical term for a single dose of a drug that's usually injected into a blood vessel over a short period of time. Okay, a bolus will sort you out right away. Okay, there you get these echoes of this Britney Spears thing that's going on here. A bolus will, the idea is that you inject something and very rapidly it will change things, okay? A system will kickstart into something that will return to health in some sort of sense. Now, it's important to say that despite the fact that, you know, he's talking about newness and a different American voice and so on, that he doesn't totally reject the achievement of those expat poets were in Europe, okay? Ezra Pound, for example, was a very big influence on him, especially Pound's own influence by French late symbolist poetry, by Japanese haiku and tanka forms, by abstraction and philosophy. All these things influenced Williams. Also, much of the Surrealist and Dada movements in Parisian modernist art were important to him. And crucially, the Imagist and Cubist movements in modern art are significant to his poetry all the way through his career. And we'll look at how they become significant later. So, let's finish this first section by thinking about the way that Williams tries to somehow displace, or not totally ignore, but somehow displace the overarching notion of despair and cynicism and worry, if you like, about the classical forms of poetry falling to bits in the modern age. You could see that The Wasteland in many ways is obviously the target here. And he wants to displace this kind of sense of overarching despair and chaotic forms of dispersion and the worry about dissolution and entropy, if you like, in modern culture, and replace these instead with forms, different emphases on experimentation, on the new possibilities of creativity, okay? On a certain confidence, if you like, that would exude through the life that he is living as opposed to, say, for example, the life that maybe someone like Eliot is trying to register in Europe. He also has, of course, an attempt at a revealing documentary vision, which he will never ever, he's never going to let go either, okay? You'll probably notice, some of you that have read some of the poems that I've handed out, that there is a documentary quality to quite a lot, actually, of Williams' work. It never really kind of defades, if you like, from his viewpoint, okay? From his ambit. But let's read what he says on Eliot. This is quote number 2 on Proof Rock, okay? Proof Rock appeared, he says. I had a violent feeling that Eliot had betrayed what I believed in. He was looking backward, I was looking forward. He was a conformist with wit, learning which I did not possess. He knew French, Latin, Arabic, God knows what. I was interested in that, but I felt he had rejected America, and I refused to be rejected, and so my reaction was violent. I realized the responsibility I must accept. I knew he would influence all subsequent American poets and take them out of my sphere. I had envisaged a new form of poetic composition, a form for the future. It was a shock to me that he was so tremendously successful. My contemporaries flocked to him, away from what I wanted. It forced me to be successful. So, to speed on, he publishes a volume called Spring and All in an obscure expatriate Paris magazine in 1923. And this, is, of course, is one of the many magazines that the American expatriate community published. It's a serial poem of 27 untitled but numbered poems. And they all run alongside a kind of fierce, furious, and vibrant polemic about poetry itself. These are the kind of like, this is a kind of slab of prose in the middle of these. I've actually put an example of it on page 1, okay? This polemic is more or less, it runs as a kind of series of declarations on the all-powerful imagination and its need for a new compact with reality. It asserts the ongoing value of the great American poets of new forms in the 19th century, you could say, like Walt Whitman, for example, but also that of important painters that Williams was hugely influenced by, especially post-expressionist painters. And many critics see a kind of like pictorial quality in Williams' poetry because of this. His idea is that if he can get his poems somehow to be like these new forms of painting, then he will have been successful. Let's take, just before we have a little break, because I like to have a kind of like a tools down moment in the lecture. Let's look at by the road to the contagious hospital as an example of everything I've kind of argued for so far, okay? And I've got Williams himself reading it, all right? If I can find it. Show me your first page. He doesn't seem to want to read it. Oh, come on. Okay, I don't know why it's not doing it. They said to me it would work, but it's not worked. Okay, let's look and see if we can get, where is it? Sorry?
The yellowy bar.
This thing?
Just under.
Oh yeah, this? Look, I'm a Mac user, all right? I'm not, you come and show me, man, come on, hurry up. Where is it? You realize you're under pressure now.
Yeah, big pressure.
It's just a YouTube clip.
It's not. It's frozen.
Oh, it's completely frozen. He's useless. Right, it's frozen, right? They always tell you never get bothered, never get involved with technology, and it usually works, but let's just read it, okay? Remember, they used to do that. The idea of reading it would be to listen to Williams himself reading it, all right? By the road to the contagious hospital, under the surge of the blue mottled clouds driven from the northeast, a cold wind, beyond the waste of broad, muddy fields, brown with dried weeds, standing and fallen, patches of standing water, the scattering of tall trees, all along the road, the reddish, purplish, forked, upstanding, twiggy stuff of bushes and small trees, with dead brown leaves under them, leafless vines, lifeless in appearance, sluggish, dazed spring approaches. They enter the new world naked, cold, uncertain of all save that they enter. All about them, the cold, familiar wind. Now the grass, tomorrow the stiff curl of wild carrot leaf. One by one, objects are defined. It quickens, clarity, outline of leaf. But now, the stark dignity of entrance, still, the profound change has come upon them. Rooted, they grip down and begin to awaken. So a few things are significant here, I think. First of all, the immediate declaration, by the road, okay? An immediate announcement that the poetry is there, okay? It's in this world, it's here. Things round about me are ready for the perception. Okay? That I'm going to make. One of the things that I think is key about this is the fact that the image of muddy fields, brown with dried weeds, standing and falling, patches of standing water, the scattering of tall trees. In the northeast, or from the northeast, seem to indicate a world that we're familiar with. Okay, a world of blasted trees, for example, seems resonant already with the image of war, for example, of obviously of winter immediately, but certainly it cannot but recall some of the despairing images that we've been looking at already on the course. However, the important thing here is a sense of regrowth, of developmentalism. Okay, something is going to happen. Look at the way that in this stanza here, the poem quickens to the present, okay? It begins to root down in something different, in new forms. Leafless vines, lifeless initially in appearance, sluggish, begin to awaken. The notion of kind of procreation, of growth, becomes significant, specifically of new growth. And the poem tightens at the close, using more heavy stresses, connected rhythms. The emphasis seems to be on the power of the gripping now. Okay? And that more positive last line, okay? The beginning of awakenings. Something new is about to emerge into the world as such. Now, I'm not going to go on about this to any kind of great degree. I mean, we can go through the whole thing. But what I think is significant about it is that there's clearly an attempt here being made. There's a line being drawn, almost, between a distinction, almost, between a concentration on winter, okay, on the old world, if you like, and a kind of parallel clarity of the new world, okay, of something different about to emerge, something far more insistent and urgent that's significant here. Now, who could this, I mean, you might ask yourself, who could they be who enter the new world naked? Some have argued, of course, that this is immediately resonant with the notion of the migrant newly appeared in American or local territory, ready to be formed into something different. Okay? That's up for the reading or not. But certainly the notion that there's some sort of endeavor here to recover a fertile new ground, from the specifically American past, a fertile new ground becomes significant. And it becomes a feature of the next volume of Williams' poems, In the American Grain, published in 1925. Here, in this volume, the basic idea is that modern America needs to rename the world in a new and fresh and vital fashion. And there's a search throughout that volume, In the American Grain, for specifically American rhythms, from hymns, folk songs, rural and urban speech, and there's an attempt in some sort of sense to relate these to direct experience. Okay, speech as it's used in spoken, for example. There's a progressive confidence in this volume, In the American Grain, in possibility, in the possibility of America, for example, and local vitality. And there's also a critical questioning of what modern decadent culture actually is. What are, for example, the pure products of America? As one of the poems that I've given you on your sheet works through. And these notions prove crucial to American modernism, and especially to William Carlos Williams. And I want to kind of read through a different trajectory of his poems in the next half of this lecture, all right? But I want to just take a minute. I usually just take minutes in my lectures to just sit, to just reboot. Okay, so do what you like. Talk to each other, have a drink, shout, stand up, stretch, do what you like, but let's just take a minute, okay? And I can see if this thing actually works. I actually want to use it, all right? Fucking hell, man. Thank you. Okay. That was not very long, but it's good just to reboot, okay? Now, I want to paint things as I see it. It's a quote that Williams made in the mid-20s. I want to paint things as I see them, okay? One of the, and I guess what he understands is one of the aims of imagism, okay? The notion or the question of how to understand or perceive the rapidly evolving modern world around them in the most appropriate form. And in a sense, he evolved what he called the new quick spontaneous poetry. He calls it the new quick spontaneous poetry. And he's influenced, as I said before, by experimental forms of painting from the Expressionists, the Impressionists, and the Post-Impressionists. And he aligns a form of kind of cubist fragmentation with specifically American visual art forms, particularly American photography. And his work has often been, especially the documentary poems, have often been linked to or likened to the Ashcan school of artists who were interested in a kind of unsentimentalized vision of American city life, and who also stress the vitality of modern urban life. So he kind of imports, you could say, European ideas about Impressionism and Cubism in order to try and apprehend a kind of like structure or form that somehow meets with the rapid, kinetic urban experience that he sees round about him. So we get kind of poems in many ways that try to mimic painting technique, especially technique of those spontaneous action painters that were circulating through American art at that time. There's an emphasis on the spontaneity of vision, on dynamic visual and physical impressions and movements. And some of these poems, some of the ones that I've given you, can be seen as attempting to bring some kind of quickened pictorial structure into the world of the poem itself. There's also a great focus on place in some of these poems, specifically the city. And there's a kind of generated tension between the apparently inconsequential, but somehow strangely significant, maybe even endlessly significant moment. And locality, in this sense, the local place, is more often than not the focus of this. And locality shouldn't just be seen geographically, but it should be seen as kind of like the jerks and outbursts of sometimes random speech rendered onto the kind of here and now of the page. And Williams is also experimenting in this phase with typography, but also where words go in relationship to the white sections of the page. Okay? The way the image itself is, how it lies on the page becomes a concern for him. And I guess rapid transit maybe brings this through, okay? Somebody dies every 4 minutes in New York State. To hell with you and your poetry, you will rot and be blown through the next solar system with the rest of the gases. What the hell do you know about it? Axioms. Don't get killed. Careful crossing campaign. Cross crossings cautiously. The horses, black and pranced, white. Outings in New York City. Ho for the open country. Don't stay shut up in hot rooms. Go to one of the great parks, Pelham Bay, for example. It's on Long Island Sound, with bathing, boating, tennis, baseball, golf, etc. Acres and acres of green grass, wonderful shade trees, rippling brooks. Take the Pelham Bay Park branch of the Lexington Avenue East Side Line, and you are there in a few minutes. Interborough Rapid Transit Co. So I guess one of the first things that really captures you when you look at this is how your eye is captured by how to read some of the sections in it. I mean, for example, do we say, you want to say the horses pranced here, don't you? Because your eye visually catches this. I mean, this is the kind of way that delineation would work, right? Black and white, of course, seems to be a couplet on the other side of the page there, but of course the way that our eye normally works is across the way, yeah? The way we would normally read it. But we know that horses prance. We know that these are obviously black and white horses, but they might not be. The question is how to read it. The question is what type of visual experience is it trying to reproduce on the page? Okay? You see, of course, horses prancing at the same time as your eye possibly registers that they're black and white. So why not write black and white horses pranced, for example? There's some kind of attempt to try and register randomness, obviously, in relation to the wider question of the seeming, and this is the paradox here, the seeming importance of this momentariness, if you like, that seems to be somehow rendering insignificant random moments in walking through the city or on the Interborough Transit line on the subway, okay, and experiencing the city through that way, that don't really matter. And I guess the poem kind of registers that in the first four or five lines. To hell with you and your poetry. You will rot and be blown through the next solar system with the rest of the gases. Poetry doesn't really mean anything here. But through the back door, it's asserting its own meaningfulness, okay, by somehow trying to get involved with what it's like to now be a person or a participant in the modern urban experience. So we get this kind of like challenge. What the hell do you know about it? And then underneath that, the emboldened axioms, okay? Truths, provable laws. Don't get killed. Straightforward, right? Now, where are these coming from? I don't know. Signs in the modern city? Who knows? Of course, modernism, as it evolves, is going to have to is trying to deal with how to deal with this, how to write through this experience, okay? How to render it somehow in language. The increasingly, you could say, difficult negotiation and navigation of a city as it fills up with sights, people, stories, narratives, and so on. Okay, think about it, right? I mean, all you guys have experienced a kind of like strange chaos of actually arriving here. Okay, on the way here, you've listened to fragments and random snippets of some other people's conversation. People that you don't know from over there, for example, you can hear at any one time. You might be thinking right now of what you want for your dinner. Maybe your stomach's rumbling. Does that somehow register on the experience of the crowd that we're in at this moment in time? The same sort of crowd that many writers are trying to engage with in the modern world, okay? Who knows, right? How are we going to appropriate that? How are we going to legislate for that in prose? Poetry seems to me to be the most appropriate, immediate answer to that, okay? The immediate register seems to me to be the form that's most open, if you like, for the understanding of this experience. Think about it. When you walk out of this lecture theatre, you're going to make, I don't know, if you walk from here to Costcutter, for example, how many different visual impressions are you going to navigate through? And how many senses are you going to use to try and codify that experience on your way to, say, Costcutter or to back to your hall? Okay? All of these different things are all bombarding your experiences and your senses at particular times. And in many ways, this poem is, you know, it's not the most experimental way to render it, but certainly it's pushing towards that. Okay. There's another important thing, obviously, here. These are the series of axioms, and you could argue, right, don't get killed and so on and so forth, but they're not specific. I mean, according to what and whom and what system? The way that the tone changes towards the end seems to me to be registering another important feature of the kind of modern metropolis, okay? It's rampant commercialism, the way that it suffuses and infuses your consciousness at every turn. So, if you think about it, I could actually read this section down here like an advertising salesman, right? A hugely important figure in modern literature, right? Don't stay shut up in hot rooms. Go to one of the great parks. Pelham Bay, for example. It's on Long Island Sound with bathing, boating, tennis, baseball, golf, etc. It's just selling you some desire in some sort of respect, right? Channeling, directing your movement through the city to some sort of source of commodified desire. Acres and acres of green grass, wonderful shade, trees, rippling brooks. Take, you know, this is how to get there. Rapid transit. And of course, the other, you know, I guess the more existential reading of the poem would push the notion of rapid transit, okay? I mean, the notion that you're not really long in this solar system. We're ultimately going to just be digestion and gases. So how do we hang on to that random experience and somehow force it into being significant? What form would be most appropriate in order to understand the particular, or the ordinary, or the mundane? Is it a long, convoluted, ornamented form of language that would be most appropriate for this? For Williams, increasingly, it's not. And he becomes enormously interested as his career moves into the 1930s and so on and so forth, with the rendering or the perception or the apprehension, in some way, of the real, but also the quotidian moment, okay? With momentariness, you could say. With the mundane, the ordinary, the quotidian. Three related terms, but not exactly the same, okay? And he becomes interested in the way that things increasingly order and understand our experience, okay? Objects. How do we relate to everyday life? Okay, how do we relate to the way that we navigate through everyday life with objects that surround it, that surround us? Okay, things that turn themselves into challenging things because, for example, maybe of their unregistered insignificance. From the 1930s, he aligned himself with a movement in poetry called Objectivism. And he supports a kind of insistence by objectivist poets that all sentimental values should be somehow dropped from verse. No symbolism is acceptable. So goes the axiom of objectivism. No symbolism can be permitted to obscure the real purpose of poetry, to lift the world of the senses to the level of imagination and give it somehow a new currency. Williams calls this a mathematics of particulars, and this kind of transfers, if you like, the plural into the one, the local into the universal. You've heard all this kind of stuff before. Whether or not all this is true or not is, of course, a term of some debate. What we often try to build around the shorter poems, for example, that Williams is very prolific in providing for us, can often be radically different, especially challengingly subjective. To make something out of these smaller poems becomes, in many ways, an important facet of what it's like to understand a different form of modernism. How do we give associative flesh, for example, to language? Okay, maybe we want to stop and think about that for a second. We seem to go ahead and do it all the time, but there's a whole gamut of things that we have to run through first and foremost before we can get a legislative, just way of saying things about modern poetry, or poetry generally. How do we give small, short fragments of experience some form of poetic flesh? How do we muster some sort of world of reference then from that? Why should we? Well, let's try, right? Let's look at the Red Wheelbarrow. Some of you would have been aware of this one. So, 22. So this is one of the most anthologized poems in existence, right? So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rain water beside the white chickens. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rain water beside the white chickens. Now, how do we read this poem? It's long been recognized as a kind of staunch contribution to modern poetry, this poem. And I guess we have to try and put ourselves here into the position of the contemporary reader, who's, I guess, more used to a kind of English poetry of rhyme schemes and stalwart rhythms and so on and so forth. And these are just 16 words. Of course, there's a system here. You might say there's a suspension system, okay? 3-1, 3-1, 3-1. Okay? So we've got that far. We might think, okay, clearly there's some sort of movement between the decision to balance the words like that on one another and the notion of the wheelbarrow itself upon which so much depends. Okay, we've got somewhere maybe with that. That the poem in some sort of sense is a mechanism. It's a machine, right? It's a suspension system. And of course, we can tease that even further if we think about the fact that so much depends upon this red wheelbarrow. Apparently, so much depends upon this red wheelbarrow. Now, it's enormously suggestive, of course. And one of the most kind of like vocal modernist critics, a guy called Hugh Kenner, K-E-N-N-E-R, famously said about this, if you're obliged to talk about poetry of this kind, your only recourse is to provide it with a theoretical scaffolding. Okay? Now, let's examine that statement and to think about the kind of sheer shock that this might actually record in the initial critic, in the contemporary critic, right? If we are obliged to talk about poetry of this kind, then what does that mean? Does that give us some indication or recognition of the fact that this is quite a revolutionary kind of like form of poetry, that it's something that's problematic in many ways for a critic more used to conventional forms? I don't know. If we are obliged to talk about it, he says, he may also mean in that sense that maybe we've just let this small, incidental, apparent, insignificant, inconsequential, elementary thought from, say, someone who might require a wheelbarrow or who needs that wheelbarrow for their work every day, some kind of relevance, right? Maybe it's just better to dignify it with silence and not to talk about it at all, not to even bother about interpreting it. But, of course, interpret it we must because, of course, we are literary critics and, of course, you all need to learn about it and pass your exams and get your jobs in the Bank of Scotland and so on and so forth, all right? But how do we put... Sorry, that's terrible, isn't it? I'm patronising you there. How do we... Should we just let this little poem, right? Another patronising way to think about it, stand on its own as some sort of declaration of a forgotten, brief, fleeting, inconsequential moment or a thought? Or should we try and attempt to scaffold it with interpretation? Given that it seems to leave so much out, we want to know further. There is a narrative here, of course, that comes from so much depends. So much depends for who? Upon a red wheelbarrow. And why a wheelbarrow? And why, for example, not a knitting needle or a steam hammer or a badge or a season ticket for Anfield? I don't know. Can we easily replace that with wheelbarrow, another incidental object? Or does the wheelbarrow itself become the focus of the experience of reading the poem and the understanding of it? Is it, for example, given that it's such a sparse poem, relating itself to, for example, a sparse environment where so much does actually, in fact, depend upon a red wheelbarrow, the machine that's going to allow you, for example, the person I'm hypothesizing here, the speaker or the thinker of this poem, to do things, to remain alive, to grow things, whatever. I don't know. Why a red wheelbarrow then? Is this an incidental, individual, specific red wheelbarrow? See, by now, because of the way that we conventionally read poetry or understand it, or the way that we think about the way that we should interpret it, you're all thinking, okay, I bet there's something in literary history, right, where there's a red wheelbarrow, and this might be allusive or suggestive of that kind of like poem where, back in the old days, right, where there was a red wheelbarrow that meant so much. And, well, I don't know. Possibly. I don't think so, though. I mean, that doesn't make... What makes this a modern poem, I guess, is the fact that it doesn't, in any sense, kind of like, you know... it doesn't worry about that, the possibility of that kind of vein of interpretation. It asserts, in many ways, an aesthetic. It's glazed with rainwater. We could say that that's an element of its pictorialness, right? The fact that it seems to kind of say... There's a kind of slight metaphorical lift there, right? Glazed with rainwater. It's an aesthetic experience, perhaps. That's the most important thing about reading this poem. Okay? The power of the mundane, everyday, ordinary experience or object becomes, you know, heightened in some sort of sense because of it. But it's a depending, it's a dependent poem, isn't it? Everything depends interpretively on the type of associative flesh you're going to put on it. And this, ultimately, it can come into, it can kind of like build out in many ways into worrying about the way that the quotidian, for example, or the insignificant domesticity of apparent details, for example, all these kind of things, right, become questionable in poetry such as this. And I guess the most insistent thing here is what makes it poetry as such? What do we expect from poetry? Poems like these ask us to think we're in the particularly modern, yes, but we're in, or what makes them poetic? What makes the experience? Is it, for example, the arrangement of the words on the page, of, you know, the rhythm, rhyme, so on and so forth? Or is it, in fact, the experience that's rendered from those arrangements? Well, of course, it's both, right? But what I think is significant about these later poems of Williams is the fact that, ultimately, we think about the way that they force us to think and argue over what constitutes a just or legitimate poetry. And that's why I want to finish quickly with "This Is Just to Say." Right? Another very, I guess, on the surface, simple poem. I've eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. So, fair enough. This is, as many people say, this is just a note on a fridge, right? It's a post-it note. There's nothing hyper-significant about it in many ways, but of course, that would be disingenuous, right? Because we know that just is some kind of operative word. And the title arrangement here, just as in what? As in a legal situation or some kind of admission of culpability that the poem turns on? Or just as in the apparent passing, casual, offhand remark that the relationship between sender and receiver of this note on the fridge, if we want to call it that, seems to delineate. But ask again, right, as you attempt, like we did with the Red Wheelbarrow, to try and build the poem's scaffold, what kind of relationship is it? Is it a kind of biting mockery, for example? Ha ha, I ate your plums. Tough, right? You know, where does that take us? All we can do is hypothesize on the relationship here. It seems more likely a note signifying some kind of understanding and cordiality between two people. Trust, for example. The poem can't itself, on the surface, answer it. But look again at the title as a kind of overall statement on the type of poetry I've been seeing that Williams writes. Okay? This is just to say that it's somehow worthy of a poem. It's legislating as a poetic moment. It is just to say this. And of course, we can't not think about taste and the sweetness of taste in this poem without thinking again of aesthetics, okay? Of the apprehension in some sort of sense of this, of the beautiful or the sweet, okay? Becomes much more a significant feature of this small incidental moment than it might initially appear. So, are poems like this simply kind of marginalia, you might ask? I guess this is their composite, but it's also their conceptual challenge. To disregard their attempt to try and evolve some significance from momentariness seems, I guess, kind of natural. But does the form of a modern poem, or a modernist poem, for example, somehow monumentalize any event? Does it provide us any kind of legitimate snapshot of the minutiae of modern living as it happens? Is it, for example, not just one of millions of incidental, flashing, you could say, quotidian moments that fluctuate through anyone's subjective life? Somehow they're elementalized by being turned into something mechanistic like this. Something more aestheticized and poetic. But it's a challenge ultimately to what we mean and understand by poetry itself, and this is one of the things that makes these poems modern. But also, what is it to turn from something that's actual and real and to transpose or capture these small moments, if you like, in words, however naturally poised or artificially arranged they might seem? Can a poem like this ever apprehend a real, if we're going to think about that in terms of the ordinary, moment? Again, what then do we mean by poetry? And what do we mean by reality, I guess, even as categories in that context? That's the question that often rises as a result of these parameters being set around a poem's analysis, especially a sparse poem such as these. Williams, I guess, then, ultimately, and this is the last thing I want to say, provides emphasis for us on a newer apprehension and construction of everyday reality. But also, one of the major things about William Strand and modernism is that it's exactly of the sort that aims to assert a shift in the nature and definition of what we might understand as cultural or culture per se, and also what we might understand to be as aesthetic, right? What we mean when we have taste, for example, as such. How we recognise how sweet stolen fruit actually is and how necessary it is to our understanding of the pleasure of it. And I guess what culture itself is becomes even more an insistent part of the work of modernism itself. It will eventually open up into newer realms, right, into wider realms. And this will become a significant feature for, I guess, the way that the course itself will evolve. Culture, of course, in this sense, in modernism, is more than just books. It's more than just William's poetry or Eliot's poetry. It's, of course, the taste of plums, right? It's the description of a soda sign. It's the end of a lecture and the subsequent conversation and discussion that arises from that. And that's it. I have an announcement to make. Sorry, I forgot to tell you this. Apparently, those of you that want to watch Absolute Beginners who are doing modes, you have to stay here because it's on in this lecture theatre right now. Okay?